Hello, hope you're doing well. Welcome to a new episode of Common Sense Podcast with me, Mike Omani, and it's a joy to have you here. I want to first start by just saying thank you to everyone who's been listening to the podcast. We are more consistent and we're seeing the growth in numbers. We're seeing new people. So welcome if it's your first time and welcome back if it's not your first time. We're doing something new today, something that I hope we can do more of. I'm now producing the podcast, so I'm also having a bit more of a say in how everything runs. And so ever so often, I want to do a dummy's guide to, right, where I'll take an issue, a problem, something in the world, and try and explore it and break it down so that you know what's going on, right? And you can suggest what you want us to talk about. So I actually put on my Instagram story. So if you don't follow us on Instagram, make sure you do. Where I asked people, okay, Israel and Palestine, what would you like to know? And people sent me lots of questions. And this episode of the podcast was basically built around those questions. So thank you. If you sent in a question, I will definitely answer it. And I picked this issue, one, because of course people care about it, but it's actually one of the reasons we started the Common Sense Network. I'm not even joking, in that when I was thinking about the media and how broken the system is, whatever, I was thinking what issues exemplify this. And for me, the conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine is one of the kind of key issues that I think exemplifies just how broken the media is. It's this difficult, intractable, deep, multi-layered conflict that's got an economic sort of part to it. It's got a religious undertone. It's got a political texture as well. And so it's really complicated. And so if you're listening, you don't really know what's going on, do not be ashamed. Honestly, like, you're not alone. There's lots of people who don't know what's going on. And the worst thing you can do is pretend. And I had FaceTime with a friend not too long ago, and we're just talking, and he was like, listen, I don't know what to tweet or what to say. Everyone's picked a side. I'm suspicious of some of the media narratives. What's going on? So if you're listening to this, it's for you. And I hope to kind of break things down. Now, because it's a dummy's guide, please, please understand, I cannot go through 75 years in a few minutes, right? It's a dummy's guide. This is meant to be simple, and my aim is, at the end of listening to this or watching this, you feel like you have a sense of what's going on, and that you can contribute to conversation, or you can you have a way to think about some of the issues. But yeah, if it's your first time, do hit subscribe and join the sort of growing family here. This conflict, for me, shows me the need, and I hope shows you the need, for trusted sources. Who don't have too much of a bias and want to report things fairly. We've seen a massive shoot in just random people who maybe are good at Canva, making posters, carousels, just saying all sorts of things online about what's going on. And these are people who don't have reporters on the ground. They're not doing any original reporting, or just parroting whatever their favorite outlet or influencer is saying. It's one of the reasons we've been quite slow at Common Sense to even put something out, because, you know, it's really hard. I want to make sure whatever I believe is factual, and it takes time to verify that. So I just want to encourage you to, at this time, lean on trusted sources. The BBC, for all its woes, if they make a mistake, they'll come back and retract it, like they did not too long ago, a few days ago. But that independent person who just tweeted something, if they're wrong, they just move on, right? They don't have that due diligence. They don't have that process. And so be skeptical of lone people telling you exactly what's going on, because they don't know. Ordinary people tend not to search for nuance. And so be very careful of equating passion and sincerity for being correct. On this issue, you can be sincere and you can be sincerely wrong. Because you're super passionate, or you're sort of posting lots of, you know the sort of black Instagram stories with lots of text, that doesn't mean you're right. It means you're passionate, which is amazing, but it doesn't equate to being right. We have to look at this with a forensic eye, really, if we're going to get to anywhere meaningful. Okay, so with all that preamble done, let's try and go through this dummy's guide really simply. So you have to be living under a rock to not have seen Israel, Palestine in the mainstream media over the last few days. And when even thinking about this, we can start so many different places. We can start literally in biblical times, but because this is meant to be a brief history, we'll start in 1957, where the United Nations basically adopted a resolution called Resolution 181. It's kind of commonly known as the Partition Plan. And what happened is it basically divided the British Mandate of Palestine into an Arab state and a Jewish state. And so people say all the time, right, that the Jewish state was born in 1948, and it was in May 14, 1948. The state of Israel was created. So Israel, we trace back to 1948, at least contemporary Israel as we know it. Now, when this happened, as you can imagine, a lot of Palestinians were displaced. In fact, estimates say about 750,000 Palestinians were displaced during this period. And the territory was basically divided into three different lands. You had the State of Israel, you had the West Bank, which is basically very near or the Jordan River, and then you had the Gaza Strip. So these are the three places that the people were moved to. The State of Israel, which is newly created, you had the West Bank, which is of the Jordan River, and you had the Gaza Strip. Now, after that 1948 sort of splitting up of people, there's just been so many tensions. We've seen so much tensions in that region. You know, Israel against Egypt, against Jordan, against Syria. And the conflicts are for a number of different reasons. From the get-go, some people didn't think Israel should have a state. But on top of that, for political reasons, for economic reasons, there's been lots of back and forths. Now, I want to zoom straight to the creation of Hamas, right, which happened slowly. Hamas was building, funded by the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But in 2006, there's an election, right, parliamentary elections in Palestine. And even though Fatah had for a long time been ruling Palestine, Hamas becomes born, right? And Hamas is this sort of radical political movement at the time that was inspired by the Muslim Brotherhood. And they basically, in that election, seized control of the Gaza Strip. Now, to give you some context, the Gaza Strip is this small piece of land. It's size of New Jersey. Think about the Isle of Wight, you know, a really small place of land, but quite a lot of people live there. In fact, reports say about 2.5 million people live there. And Hamas now controlled basically this strip of land. The difficulty right from the get-go is a lot of people did not recognize Hamas's control of this region, because Hamas in their founding charter committed to the destruction of Israel. So in their sort of founding document, they said the Israel state must not exist. And so they committed to wiping Israel off the face of the earth. For that reason, many organizations around the world, many countries around the world, designated Hamas to be a terrorist organization. And so people didn't acknowledge their electoral victory. But ever since then, Hamas took control of the country, right? And essentially, there's never been an election since. They've basically ruled with an iron fist that whole region. Now, as you can imagine, there's been lots of violence as well between Hamas, the Fatah party that used to rule. Again, lots of bloodshed, people going back and forth. Between 2006 and 2011, there's just lots of failed peace talks, deadly confrontations, you know, so on and so forth. And later on, in about 2014, Fatah and Hamas decide we're going to form a unity government and basically start governing Palestine as it's known. That's a very brief history as to sort of where things were before October the 7th and the sort of terrorist attack that we're talking about today. So what's happening now? Where are we? Well, October the 7th is a day that sort of rocked the world, because shocked Israelis basically woke up on the last day of their Jewish holidays with sirens, you know, fear. Everyone's terrorized, wondering what's happened. And essentially, Hamas and Islamic Jihad have basically fired lots of rockets from Gaza. They've broke down the high-tech barriers that surrounded the strip, and they've entered Israel, and then they've started shooting and taking hostages. there is a electronic dance music festival happening with young people. Hamas storm it, murder hundreds of people. And this, even though there's been lots of violence in the region for a while, is staggering and unprecedented because it's never happened before like this. That Hamas were able to launch such a catastrophic, well-organized attack on Israel. And people blame it on intelligence failure because Israel should have known. Israel is an advanced country. They should have known what's going on. But we knew that when that happened, that it would have long-lasting repercussions and consequences. And so Benjamin Netanyahu, who is the prime minister of Israel, he basically at this stage declares that Israel's at war and that Hamas would pay a very, very heavy price for what they had just done. Hey there, just want to say thank you for listening or for watching this podcast. We have a great desire to grow this podcast. And one of the ways we're going to do that is if you listening follow, or if you are watching, you subscribe to the podcast. The faster it grows, the more guests we can get, but also the better the podcast gets. So please just do me a favor, hit the subscribe button or the follow button. Back to the episode. Now, the response from Israel is one that's drawn lots of backlash. But after that attack on their country, Israel basically started to attack back, right? So they started to basically, they started with airstrikes on the Gaza Strip on Saturday morning. They called up lots of army reservists and launched even more airstrikes days after. And so the Gaza Strip, that has this tiny strip of land that has 2.3 million people, where Hamas is buried under underground tunnels and things like that, bombs starts falling. And naturally, people die. Innocent civilians die. The Israeli prime minister will say, well, we were warning people to get out of there, right? Warning civilians to get out of there because he vowed to reduce Hamas's hideouts to a rubble. But as you can imagine, it's very hard to get out of a densely populated area when it's not as though all the neighboring countries are friendly to you. So unfortunately, civilians have died since. Now, on top of this, Israel then says, well, we're now going to actually get ready for a ground invasion. We're going to march into the Gaza Strip and literally root out Hamas, get rid of this terrorist organization that's committed to our destruction and our death, etc., etc. So far, it's very hard to ascertain numbers. As you can imagine, I'm here in London. We don't have reporters on the ground. But so far, at least 700 Israelis have been killed. We have about 2,000 people who are receiving treatments in hospitals. We've got over 30 people in critical condition as early as Sunday. And there's been lots and lots of confusion about who's responsible for what death, right? Because at the same time, the Israelis have been bombing the Gaza Strip. And again, at least 600 Palestinians, innocent Palestinian civilians, have also died. So there's death and bloodshed in both different directions. Now, some of the questions that people have asked that I guess get into some of this, into this conflict in a bit more detail. People have asked, well, Mike, why did Hamas and Islamic Jihad launch this attack? Like, you know, weren't things stable? Well, the truth is things have never been stable. Of course, you always have brief periods of ceasefire, but things have not been stable. It's hard to ascertain exactly why Hamas attacked in this way, but there has been growing violence in that region for some months now. We've had armed settlers attacking Palestinian villages. We've had militants in the West Bank attacking soldiers. And there's also been lots of things happening outside where Israel has started talking to other countries like Saudi Arabia in the region about deals and peace talks. And so Hamas was starting to get a bit nervous that, hold on a minute, Israel seems to be normalizing the current situation. And what is that current situation? Well, you probably heard terms like open prison camp or illegal occupation, apartheid state, these sort of terms used. The reason why those terms are used is because in all the successive wars that's been fought in this region, Israel has really consolidated power such that Israel controls pretty much the water and the electricity in that region. And so the state of Israel, because it has control over the Gaza Strip in terms of these precious resources, They, in order to control Hamas, have always sought to switch on, switch off, control, you know, the kind of flowing of resources to keep Hamas at bay. And for that reason, a lot of people say there's been many, many humanitarian crises that's been committed, because water and electricity should be a human right that everyone gets, irrespective of whether you're the people ruling your party are terrorists or not. Everyone should, the people ruling your country, sorry, everyone should get access to clean water, electricity, so on and so forth. And so the narrative you might have heard is that, well, all that's happening here, and the reason why Hamas committed this attack, is because they wanted to break free from their oppressor, from the people who had been occupying illegally their country for all these different years. That doesn't take into account the fact that there is really no way to negotiate with Hamas, who aren't interested in a two-party or two-state solution, which means basically one of the ways to kind of get peace in the region is to have two separate countries that are sovereign. Hamas, that's committed to the destruction of Israel. How do you have a conversation with someone who's committed to your destruction? You can understand why there's a rebuttal there as well. But it's very, very hard to understand why Hamas did this, because this doesn't advance their cause in any way, shape, or form. Now, if you hold that they're murderous terrorists, then you don't need to have a reason. They did it because they're murderous terrorists, and this is part of their kind of philosophy. But at the same time, you have to ask yourself, well, if you've got this situation where innocent Palestinians can't live a life because they're under the rule of essentially Israel controlling their natural resources, how else do you fight back, right? That's also a narrative you may have heard too, but it's hard to ascertain. The second question says, why did the attack take Israel by surprise? Well, again, it's hard to know. Hamas must have been planning this offensive for many, many months. It's still a mystery why Israeli intelligence didn't pick this up or see this coming. We've had different intelligence operations basically say they warned Israel about this attack that was oncoming. In the thick fog of war, it's really hard to know what's what. It's when maybe there's a ceasefire, maybe there's an agreement, maybe there's some sort of kind of subsiding of conflict that we may be able to investigate and work out who knew what at what stage and what's been going on. So that's how I would answer that one. Someone says, what does Hamas hope to gain? It's hard to know. Like I said, this militant group has ruled the Gaza Strip since 2007. They have shown the world that they would do anything to get their point across, like kidnapping hostages, killing people, raping people, killing children, beheading people. These are things that they've done in the past. But it's hard to know what they hope to gain. You know, it's one of those things where you could say, well, they want freedom and liberation, and sure, you could see why they would want that. But again, because of their commitment to destroying Israel, you have to ask yourself, well, you know, in what way could they ever be allowed to achieve what they want if those two things are part and parcel of the same thing? Another question is, does Hamas have the support of ordinary people in Gaza? Now, this is a good question, a very interesting question, because it's a question I often ask. Because if you think about this framing, if you've got a terrorist group that controls the whole country and the people don't want this terrorist group to control the whole country, shouldn't they revolt and, you know, fight against this terrorist group? From what I've been able to read and find, most people in Gaza just want to get on with their lives. They want to live free of the blockade. They want to be able to have water, build a life. You know, they want to be free from the repeated wars and conflicts. And they want the restrictions imposed on them by Hamas, right, to actually stop, because Hamas rules them with an iron fist. But at the same time, the Palestinian people also want freedom from the Jewish state that currently controls every single part of their daily life. You know, it's sort of, they've been taken hostage by Hamas, but also been held hostage by the Israeli government, who are afraid of Hamas gaining too much control. And so the Palestinian people are kind of caught between a rock and a hard place, either the oppressors at home or the oppressors beyond the wall, so to speak. But essentially, that's what you can read from those who live in Gaza. Next question says, what has the international reaction to Hamas been? Well, if you watch the news, you'll see almost every few hours or so, there's a new country condemning Hamas and supporting Israel's right to self-defense. Leaders have to say this because Israel is a sovereign country. It's a democracy where you can actually vote people out and vote them in, etc. Unlike Palestine right now, where Hamas has have ruled with an iron fist for many, many years. And so for the most part, the international reaction has been supporting Israel's right to defend itself. But there's also been lots of people who have also been skeptical about Israel's sort of reading of this situation as a sort of blank check to do whatever they want to destroy Hamas. You know, Joe Biden told Netanyahu when he visited that the US stands with the people of Israel. And he said that the support is going to be rock solid and unwavering, but he's also encouraged the prime minister to show some restraint and to not be like the terrorists himself, because the terrorists may destroy and kill people with no remorse, no care for civilian life. You know, everything is seen as a righteous struggle, which you know, where the collateral has to be human life. And I suppose the expectation from the West is that Israel wouldn't behave like terrorists and would actually show some restraint and would attempt, as possible as it is, to wage a war on Hamas whilst minimizing or having no civilian casualties. The reality is, most people who study conflicts know this is impossible. You cannot be at war and no one die. You know, that this is a very, it's unheard of for that to be the case. And so how they root out Hamas without any civilian casualties is hard to imagine, but that is the expectation from most of the countries I've seen in the West. The next question someone asked me is who bombed your hospital? So for those who don't know, there was a hospital attack, which every sort of news outlet was really, really quick to report that this might have been a Israeli rocket that struck this hospital, killing, at the time was reported, about 500 people. Now, this is one of the things that really bothered me about the reporting of this this particular incident, because a lot of people were very quick, because of sort of confirmation bias, to just say the person that did it is the side of this war that I least like, right? And so everyone, a lot of people I know, were very quick to say, well, it's the Israeli government, it must be the Israeli government. And vice versa, some people say this, you know, it's definitely Hamas, you know, this is something they do, et cetera, et cetera. We should have shown restraint. And what we should have said is we don't know, because the evidence was inconclusive. It was very hard to tell. There had been no outside parties allowed in to kind of maybe look at the wreckage and try to ascertain what could have caused it. And even though many outlets reported it was Israel, now a lot of them are walking it back, because intelligence agencies, at least the UK government one, have judged that the explosion was likely caused by a missile that was part of or that Gaza launched towards or that was launched, sorry, from within Gaza. So it could have been Hamas, it could have been Islamic Jihad, but the idea is that it came from Hamas and it was going towards Israel, and it burned out of fuel or exploded, and that's how it killed people. Now, that's what the intelligence agencies say. Now, do I believe them 100%? No. But I do believe in trusted sources, because I don't know how else I am meant to ascertain what happened thousands of miles away if I don't trust independent intelligence agencies. I don't know how I'm meant to do that. Now, should you exercise caution? Yes. Should you be skeptical? Absolutely. But the best we have from independent folks who have assessed this, from intelligence agencies that we believe doing other things, is that it was probably launched from Gaza going towards Israel. I'm still not sure. There's no conclusive data. I have no reason to sort of have a conclusive sort of approach to this as of yet. So that's my take on that. Someone then asked me, saying, what's a Christian take on all of this stuff? And I found this quite an interesting question, because Christians debate very vigorously, and there are lots of different theological approaches to contemporary Israel. There are some who believe absolutely that contemporary Israel is exactly the Israel spoken about in the Bible. There's many, many scriptures, not most notably in Psalms and Jeremiah, where prophecies are given about Israel, Israel being God's chosen people. God is preparing the land for Israel. These are promises that are biblical. And there are folks who, on one side, absolutely believe that we are to stand with Israel and offer them unwavering support. Israel is God's people. The Israelites are God's people. The Jewish people are God's people. And so we stand with God, we stand with Israel. You've had people like Paula White say things like that. And then on the other end, you have people who are swung in the other direction who say, well, if you look at the way Palestinians have been ignored, how they've been treated in the West Bank under Israeli occupation, there is no way that God would be for this. And so we stand with the Israeli people. As a Christian, I think the answer is somewhere in between, in that it's hard to deny the biblical reality of what God says about Israel. I believe that as a Christian. But at the same time, there is no way I could stand and watch people dying, suffering, being unjustly treated, and I turn a blind eye and say it's God's people. That makes no sense to me. Jesus was moved by compassion, cared deeply about injustice. And so I think it's really important to actually be someone who stands against injustice, irrespective of who it comes from. Hey there, just want to say thank you for listening or for watching this podcast. We have a great desire to grow this podcast. And one of the ways we're going to do that is if you listening follow, or if you are watching, you subscribe to the podcast. The faster it grows, the more guests we can get, but also the better the podcast gets. So please, just do me a favor, hit the subscribe button or the follow button. Back to the episode. This is one of the reasons I find it really difficult to chant Free Palestine or to chant Free Israel or chant for Israel, because neither of those chants get deep into what's going on here, which is competing ideologies, a terrorist group, a people that are locked out of what's theirs, their human right, because of a party's fear of a terrorist group. I mean, it's quite multi-layered, and these kind of chants of people sharing the amount of Palestinian people that have died without also sharing the Israelis that have died, it just goes to sort of show, I think, people not taking this seriously. And when I say seriously, I don't mean not caring. Of course they care. But I mean not realizing the multiple parties that are involved in this conflict and how the conflict is continually perpetuated. The issue is we have people who vehemently chant Free Palestine, but don't understand the rationale of the Israeli government and their fear, their irrational fear of a terrorist group that's hell-bent on their destruction. And you have people, too, who say, well, Israel's gone through so much historically, who don't understand that the same persecution Israel is under throughout the whole biblical story, they are now subjecting innocent Palestinians to. And that failure to actually understand what the other side is saying is what perpetuates this conflict, right? And it happens on the West here, where people will only ever say Free Palestine if you ask them, well, would you condemn what Hamas did? They'd be like, no, the issue is Palestine, how the Palestinians are treated. And you go, you're missing the point here. Your failure not to be able to hold both things in tension is what perpetuates conflict. It's what perpetuates a misreading. And now, unfortunately, a lot of this has been spun into the binary that exists on social media, where it's, you know, you either care about Palestine or you care for Jewish people. You're either an oppressor or you're the oppressed. And those binary narratives are just, they're not apt for what's going on. The issue here isn't about oppressor and oppressed. The issue here is about fear, overexertion of power, people's human rights. Like it's multifaceted, and it needs people to sit around the table and attempt to understand each other's perspective, because that's the only way we have solutions. And for all the Instagram stories we share and all the tweets we write about what's going on, any conflict needs strong leadership where people can sit around the table and talk and negotiate and agree. There is no other way through a conflict. Name a conflict that's been solved because the UN said something or because one person randomly did something. Absolutely not. It's parties coming together, especially if it's going to be long-lasting change. Someone told me to share the truth. They said share the truth was their question to me. And I also have a problem with this, because there is the truth, as in the fact that happened. But as you can imagine, what you have here in this intractable conflict is lots of perspectives, honestly held, vehemently sort of held, you know, really deeply believed perspectives that are all valid and rational. If I was Jewish and I have this long shared history with other Jewish, where 6 million of us were gassed during the Holocaust, and we've been through this shared history of just being persecuted, and now we have a Jewish state, and it's the only Jewish state in the world. And we have this one group that's right by our border that's committed to our destruction, committed to murdering us. I understand why I would want to root out that group so they'd never exist ever again. I understand that. And likewise, if I was a Palestinian, through a lottery, I was born in the Gaza Strip, and my whole life has been controlled by a foreign country that I do not know, and they control my every morning, you know, decisions, even like they control whether I can go in, go out. I understand how I would grow up with deep hatred of that party. Of course I get that. And I think until someone can understand both those two plights, we're just going to keep chanting different things in our echo chambers without any genuine attempt to say, how do we start to move towards some sort of resolution? How do we get to a place where innocent lives aren't needlessly lost? And we're not just reading numbers on a news bulletin, like these aren't actual people and actual stories, you know. That's what I would say to that question of sharing the truth. It's really about perspective, this. And I think we in the West here, you know, do a couple of tweets, make a couple of posters on Canva, you know, do an Instagram live, and we sort of think we've arrived at this enlightened place, not realizing the real multi-layered, complex things at play here. Now, this was a dummy's guide, so I'm sorry if you listen to this, you go, actually, no, I disagree with this part, or this wasn't explained properly. Fair enough. I kind of took on the risk of offending or not saying something correctly when I made this episode. I knew there's no way I could do it justice, right? So the aim is to give you enough to have a conversation, enough to understand what's going on, and I think that's been achieved. I would love to know what you think, though. You know, whether you agree with me or not, or you want to add something to the conversation, drop a comment, you know, let me know what you think, and let's start a conversation going. Hopefully one that's biased, that's charitable, that's nuanced, and that pushes the world towards some sort of solution, right? As ever, thank you so much for listening to this. I hope it was helpful, and I will see you in the next episode.